Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of The Wild Hunt, the No Ship Network podcast on the History Channel television series Vikings. I am your host, Steve.
And I am your host, Em. And tonight we are discussing Vikings Season 5, Episode 16, titled The Buddha. This was written by Michael Hirst and directed by Stephen St. Lager. A quick discussion about the recent announcement of Vikings ending its series run on the upcoming Season 6, which will be spread out over 2019, 2020, and 2021, I believe. And Sarah Powers had deduced this, I think, through Instagram photos early on, and now it has been proven that her detective work was correct, and Season 6 is the final run of Vikings, and we will be here to cover it, and everybody better drive carefully and survive until the final episode of Vikings so we can have an awesome podcast to record. I don't know what we're going to do. We got plenty of time to think about it, but we should have a special episode to tie everything up, to show our appreciation for this journey. The Buddha journey we've been on.
All is one and one is all. So the little screen capture Facebook post that my friend had sent to me, a friend who doesn't even watch the show or listen to the podcast, but knows that we do it. And it said it had the confirmation that it would end in Season 6, but it also said there was going to be a spinoff.
But there's also something else in the works, which I've told you about this before with Michael Hirst and Martin Scorsese on a series about Rome. So that will be interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, Martin Scorsese working with Hirst.
And on Rome.
Yeah. I mean, that's almost just a bonus that it's on Rome. But so as long as the spinoff's not about Iceland, we should be okay.
Yeah.
That'll be the lowest rated show of all time. Unless we could get Floki to rap on it. And then I don't know if that would help. So is Iceland, is that going to be our first location?
Yes. So we're going to start with Iceland, as we usually do, just to get it over with.
Yeah.
Iceland opens up with Floki's flock making do with fish food remains to be found, and they may be responsible for Ludafisk.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate that.
Well, we haven't tried it. We can't really denounce it.
Uh-huh. All right.
I mean, the reputation sounds quite daunting.
I don't know any lepers, but I'm not going to run out and join one of their fucking clubs. John Bender.
It seems like their feast was actually pretty good because nobody's grimacing at the dinner table. But while they're eating, Helgi is Hearn out in the wilderness, yelling Floki's name, and he has returned frostbit and teetering on death.
How do you feel about this whole situation with him coming back and then wanting to convince everybody there to go help these people they seem to have just exiled, even though there's been a time lapse because he talks about how they traveled far and then built a house and so on and so forth. Now everybody's falling ill, and does it feel like a trick?
It smacks of shenanigans.
Yeah, shenanigans. Can you explain shenanigans?
It's a deceitful or treacherous trick. Well, it smacks of shenanigans. Actually, sounds more like an animal cookie or something. Like you'd have a little box of Avon cookies instead.
They would be like way more gingery than sweet. You know, like they wouldn't taste.
They'd
that
be,
good.
Have a biting flavor.
Like they're ginger snaps, but they would be way more like it would be almost like that real harsh ginger flavor rather than any kind of sugar to it. That's how I would picture those. So anyway, seriously though, so I think we're on the same page that there's a likelihood that there is something going on that's not completely above the level.
Yeah, and I felt this before I even saw the next time on. Mm-hmm. So I'll just say that.
Yeah, I barely remember what was on the next time on. I mean, I guess I'll just be surprised next week.
But Floki seems to have reservations himself about this. Mm-hmm. But he leaves it up to Flatnose to make the decision. And Flatnose needs to believe in hope in order to survive. And so I guess his reasoning stems from that, and that's why he decides to go and rescue Avon's family, and he says that he would carry Avon on his back if he has to.
I really like his character. I think he's a great stand-up guy, but I think sometimes you can almost be too much in that direction and just try to see too much of the good in people even when it doesn't exist. I see why Floki gave him the choice in this matter, because he lost his son and his daughter to this bullshit family that's doing all this shenanigans. And so I understand that. But at the same time, I feel like Floki should have known that Kettle was going to come to this conclusion because of the nature of the man himself. So it was almost just a formality for him to ask. I think once Helgi showed up and asked for this help, it was kind of a foregone conclusion that they were going to do it.
Floki just didn't want the responsibility. So if shit goes south, he'd be like, dude, you were the one that wanted this man.
They killed your family and you said you'd still want to go get him. So let's get him. You know, I question the wisdom, though, of the traveling that's being done at the end of this scene, because I know Helgi sort of admonishes them that, hey, we got to get to my family fast. We've already buried two or three young ones. What is it? Two or three? I think you'd remember. And, you know,
yeah.
Your dad's super sick and other people are sick. So it's like, we got to get there fast, but you're, for the same reason, you don't go raiding in the winter. Ivar wants to go wait till spring to go to England with his new buddy. And, it just makes sense to kind of wait, because these people in the camp where everything is going as good as it can, I guess, are still malnourished and weak.
I guess it's just showing their superiority in the good guy department, because they're willing to
get out there
in the inclement weather and save people when it's urgent.
I'm not any more impressed with this storyline, but they do a great job of making Iceland look like a dreary hell on earth.
Oh, hell yeah. But you know, like, you have to wonder about what are your plans as far as settlement is concerned when you're all one family? Like, how's the breeding going to manifest itself? You've banished the other family that you could have bred with.
Right, because you're not, I mean, at some point it's going to be thin anyway, because you're talking about, like, cousins.
Yeah.
At the very best.
Yeah.
Like that's the closest relation, you know, like cousins are going to be breeding. It's like, okay, we can deal with that. But then, like, when you separate it out, like you're talking about, it's going to have to be brothers and sisters, you know, or something like that. Cause otherwise you're just not going to produce more members of the family. So what section are we off to next?
So next we are going to cover York.
Okay.
Harold arrives back in York with Magnus. He arrives defeated without Jarl Olofsson, the man who I'll call the Mountain from, like, maybe season 2, season 3 time frame of Game of Thrones, since there's been a series of mountain actors from Game of Thrones, but he reminds me of the very tall guy. Mm-hmm. He is not pleased. He doesn't believe in giving second chances to fools and failures. Mm-hmm. And I really like this next line from Harold, because he says he used to believe the same thing, but you live and learn, but he still ends up having to prove his strength and kill this man, among others.
Well, he brings up a good point. You become awfully wasteful with leadership skills, with pools of talent, with potential allies, with a lot of stuff when you hew too closely to this ethic of, if you fail at all, you're a complete failure and you just deserve to be killed or ostracized or whatever. I just don't see how a culture gets very far with that being the prevailing ethic going on. And I'm not saying you have to suffer fools and give them chances over and over to keep fucking things up, but even the best leaders are going to falter sometimes, and it's the strength of their character that lets them get back up and carry on and do better things, right, and learn from those mistakes, you know. So
yeah, that line also made me think of Michael Hurst as a person, you know, what wisdom is he passing on to us through writing Vikings.
So I like this scene, because I like the way that Harold was able to work the crowd in this. He took something that he made the assumption after he killed those guys and after his group killed those guys that everybody could still be friends. Like, he was saying, okay, it's not going to be my people that I just brought back versus your people who stayed here, and we're going to fight to the death. He's like, friends. Here we have, I brought with me the, you know, I didn't get to tell you this yet, but I brought with me the son of Ragnar Lothbrok, Magnus. And, you know, with him, we're going to be undefeatable and so on and so forth. And everybody kind of jumps on board. So I thought it was, like, pretty deft leadership, which kind of gives the lie to what this tall guy was saying in the first place. Like, he is a good leader. He knows how to get the people on his side for a cause. And so I thought it was a good moment for Harold.
Yeah, he's motivating them by bringing them into the fold and also promising an empire that's going to stretch from York to Kattegat, from Ireland to Francia, from Scotland, and to the steppes of Rus. And also, we see that he has a use for Magnus.
Yeah.
We were wondering why he was bringing Magnus along, and he's just going to use him as a prop.
Yeah.
To motivate. Well, he's going to have another Ragnarsson in tow here soon anyway. One that's less appealing.
One that's less appealing to him, because it's not controllable.
Not controllable and could take over.
Yeah. But, you know, I don't know how much he honestly has to worry about that, though, because Bjorn hasn't seemed to really, for a while now, he hasn't seemed to be really in this, like, leadership mode of where he wants to come in and like, he wants to take back Kattegat from Ivar, because he feels like Ivar shouldn't have it. You know, Ivar has this vendetta against his mom. He feels like he's fulfilling his dad's dream in his own way. Mm-hmm. But I don't feel I can understand why Harold would think that that's a threat, but I just don't think that it really is. I think that Bjorn really feels like he could just kind of be a plug into a group that's already going to do what he wants to do. They have the same goals. He doesn't have to come in there and orchestrate and be their leader, and I don't think he wants to.
Yeah, and I imagine Harold probably has an understanding about Bjorn by now, after been around the Ragnarssons for a few years now, even went to Francia with them. But, you know, he probably worries about the pull that Bjorn's going to have on his men and take away some of his base of power.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, but it'll only become an issue, though, if they start to butt heads on something.
So yeah, as long as possible.
Yeah. As long as they're on the same page, everything's hunky-dory.
And another thing that seems to bother Harold about Bjorn's visit is the fact that Bjorn and Gunnhild seem to be in a budding romance, and he watches that from afar, obviously dissatisfied with that development.
You could see his cheek twitch a little bit, and I'm not sure, but on the second viewing, I thought like his eye got a little watery, like he was just so, you know, because this guy can, you can, there's a lot of bad stuff you can put him on him as a Viking and as a leader. He's done some treacherous things for sure, but at the same time, he does have this almost innocence and naivety in the sense of how he's approaching love and stuff like that. I don't think it's going to do him a service because he's just so starry-eyed
about it.
It's
more like ignorance, not really innocence.
Yeah, you're right.
And he's definitely keeps striking out in the love department.
Yeah. You just can't kidnap your way into a really strong, healthy relationship. So, super edit.
Our next location is going to be Kattegat.
Ah.
Once again, Kattegat ranks as the second most boring location, though it has gotten better. It's actually providing a little bit of comic relief in this episode. Kattegat opens up with Fitzurk in the marketplace, where he meets a foreign merchant, and through him, he discovers the Buddha. When he asks who is the Buddha, the man laughs maniacally.
What does that laugh mean? Is it just kind of like, is he just incredulous at the fact that somebody's expecting him to explain what the Buddha is in one like simple paragraph or sentence or something like that? Or
I know for me, if I was in Fitzurk's shoes and that happened, I would be annoyed and say, dude, you don't even know how to answer this question. Why don't you just admit that shit? But and then walk away. Where I think Fitzurk finds it completely intriguing, because I think Fitzurk has like a mischievous kind of quality about him. I think that appeals to him.
And he's at this point, too, I think he's very open to different ideas because he's looking for signals, literally. He's looking for a reason why the gods have put him on this path. And it maybe he's even open to the idea that it doesn't have to be the gods as he knows them, because he's not like looking at Buddha as a god, and which it shouldn't be done anyway, because that was never the point of Buddhism. I'm not too familiar with it, but I don't think they revere Buddha as a deity. It's more of a person who is the embodiment of a lot of beliefs and so on. But
so do you think like Fitzurk senses the vacuum that has developed since the seer's demise? Like it could like be one that's actually in his own mind. Mm-hmm. But it also could be something that is maybe metaphysically present, if that's a good word for that, because of the symbolic representation that the seer figured in as in the story.
I like that. I hadn't thought of that at all. It hadn't occurred to me. But like, if you subtract the seer out from the Vikings, at least in Kattegat, you're doing it symbolically for all of them because of the later stage that we're at, right? So then you say, like you said, a vacuum. That's a perfect way to describe it. That's really good, because then all of these other cultural influences can, because nature abhors a vacuum.
Right.
So they kind of come in and fill in these blank spaces where people are looking for answers and don't have anybody to guide them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, because I was going to kind of comment on like, isn't it weird where like how we get other cultures dropped in every now and then at these like seemingly random intervals, but this one isn't random. So I have to scratch that whole thing. That makes sense now that you said that. It is like this idea, these different ideas and philosophies that Fitzurk is soaking up are coming in because of a vacuum that's been created.
So you're saying you felt like it was random until the idea of the vacuum?
Until you proposed the idea of the vacuum, I thought I was going to make like just kind of like a side comment about how, you know, this, it's a historical show. So like, we get drips and drops of the other cultures in the world that that come in. But here we have something that was just dropped in our lap. And without that context of the vacuum, like you just introduced, in which I agree with, I felt like it would have been somewhat just here you go. But now it makes perfect sense.
So next we have Ivar informing Fitzurk of Harald's defeat in Wessex. And he is now planning on heading to Wessex himself so he can gloat over, I think, Harald's defeat and hit home the idea that this happened because he can't do it without Ivar. I do wonder if there are going to be ships literally passing in the night because we're going to have Harald heading to Kattegat and we're going to have Ivar heading the opposite direction. Maybe there'll be a spitball fight in the night over the sea as they pass each other. I don't know.
They're throwing fish bones at each other. So there's a good bit of naivety going on Ivar's part in this scene, in my opinion, because he is, like you said, attributing the loss of Harald's forces to the fact that Ivar the Boneless, the god on earth, the member of the Aesir, was not there to help the army, rather than the fact that the army came up against a force that had been somewhat hardened and disciplined and trained by three or four of the greatest Viking warriors of the time. Let's see. What do you think makes more sense?
Ivar is building his army as well as Harald here because he tells Fitzurk at the time that he's talking about going to Wessex that he just had an emissary visit from Olaf the Stout.
Yes.
And he has invited his men to join his army. So in a way, this episode is kind of showing how, some of our locations or power bases are trying to coalesce and form where there's a little bit of shaky ground in Wessex, even after their victory due to Alfred's health. I forgot to mention when he tells Fitzurk about Harald's defeat that he also knows that Uba, Bjorn, and Lagertha were on the side of Wessex and were part of the defeat of Harald. And this is when Fitzurk says, so you knew all along the sacrifice was in Lagertha. And Ivar and Freydis smile in this sort of patronizing way at Fitzurk, like, of course we knew. We're wise rulers.
If Odin himself had come down from Valhalla and took their heads off at that point, I would have smiled. The hatred that I felt for both of those characters at that point, because this poor woman who was screaming and begging for her life, she was hung upside down, her throat was slit, then she was doused with, accelerant and lit on fire just so they could try to prove to people that, he had gotten one of his goals. And it's just, man. I mean, I don't really know how I would have felt any different if Fitzurk had brought that up and they just had stone faces about it. I don't think it would be like, I don't think they'd be any less culpable, obviously. But the fact that they smiled, like you said, patronizingly is just galling.
It is galling. And they deserve what's coming to them because I believe it is.
Yeah. The more I think about it, the more I feel like there's a faster doom coming for Ivar. I had thought at one point that he was going to last till the end of the series and be this great leader that we might even have felt some sort of sympathetic notes towards in a small capacity in the future. But I think all traces of that are gone and he is definitely on the side of the bad.
And the scene ends with Ivar looking forward to heading to Wessex, specifically because he wants to play chess again with Alfred, except this time he wants to do it on the battlefield. So this is a way to remind us about that time in Ivar's past where he traveled with Ragnar and met Alfred, and they did play chess, and they seem to have a friendly bond. But these things don't impact Ivar in the way they impact others.
Yeah. And, even Alfred, I think Alfred will have a respect for that relationship, but he's not going to put his country at risk for it. So
I can't wait till Ivar meets Magnus, though. I really... I think I might be happy with how that turns out. Like, I might root for Ivar. Like, the one time I root for him this season. We have a scene with Fitzurk and his girlfriend, Thora.
Thora, yeah. And the only reason we know that now is when you pause on the Amazon Prime where we watch it, it shows you the names of the actors and then who they play. And there's finally a spot for this actress. And it has her name. So we still haven't heard it said out loud in the actual show. No one has referred to her and she hasn't said it, but now we know it's Thora.
Instead of calling her Fitzurk's side piece. I'm going to call her his thought piece because she seems wholly to exist to provide us with what he's thinking. So instead of having voice over narration, we have we have Thora to provide us with what Fitzurk is thinking. And he's thinking a lot about the Buddha.
Yeah, because they haven't had a conversation to where she's had a thought that she's expressing. She's just, you're right. She's just there to be this like receptacle of his thoughts so we can hear it. So it's not just him talking to the crowd.
Right.
That's lame. But, you know, I mean, there's that. And, well, wait, hold, there's sex too. She's mm-hmm. there for sex too. So we can't.
Yeah. Let's not talk about the Buddha for now. Let's just go ahead and have sex.
Right.
But he's very much attracted to the idea of this journey because, you know, I think you've really been in tune with Fitzurk's relationship with the gods up to this point and how he's kind of dealt with his decision making, which I don't even think he sees it as decision making on his part, really. He's just yeah. feels like he's flotsam that's caught up in the will of the gods. Maybe the idea of the Buddha's decree about life being a journey has a little bit more of appeal to it, and it can eradicate some of the contradiction that he's going to talk about with Ivar here in a minute.
I think you're absolutely correct on that, because that's what I had in my notes about the episode, is that when he's telling Thora these things, talking about, like, you know, life is a bridge, don't build a house on it, and life is a river, but don't cling to the banks,
yeah.
and stuff like that, I really got the impression that this was going to appeal to him on that level that you just described, on how he's confused about why, you know, he did step off the boat with Ube, but he's sticking to his guns, in the sense that he feels that there's going to be a reason that's going to be made evident to him at some point. And I think he's starting to feel like this line of thinking and philosophy is probably the conduit for that.
Well, my question is, though, getting that reason or thinking you're going to have a reason given to you, is that not the same thing as clinging to the banks? I mean, does there have to be a reason?
Ah, that's true, because then you're looking at the destination and not the journey. And
right.
all of the philosophy always focuses on the journey. Don't right. worry about the destination, because you're getting there anyway at some point.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So he might have to, maybe he's going to have to shed just looking for answers in general if he really wants to jump in all the way with this.
Mm-hmm.
He's just going to have to say, I don't care anymore. It's going to be made evident when it's made. When it's made evident, and I'm just here to do what I need to do.
So any inkling how this could lead into the huge sacrifice this year talked about with Fitzurk on his part? I can't figure it out.
No, I'm drawing a blank on that for now. Hopefully it'll become a little clearer as we get closer. I'll try not to cling to the banks on that one.
So later Fitzurk studies the Buddha figure he has in his hand while sitting in the presence of Ivar. And it's funny because he's looking at this figure, then he looks over at Freydis, and I don't know what his thought process is, but something's happening there. But she looks like she has a Buddha belly. I don't know if that indicates anything to him
yeah.
in that way. Ivar sits down with Fitzurk, and this is actually where he mentions Olaf the Stout, which we've already talked about. We just got a little bit out of order. Sorry about that. But it's funny because he's talking about his divine child that's soon going to be brought into this world. And Fitzurk just responds with this, like, indifferent stare.
Yeah.
Which doesn't really upset Ivar to the point where you would think it would go. In fact, I thought this was probably the more saner responses that we've gotten from Ivar in a while.
The more measured, at least.
Yeah. Okay. Measured would be a better word. But he does say, why so cynical? And I think we're supposed to think, why so serious? Which, again, points to insanity. So,
I like how Fitzurk handled it, like, overall, because he's past the point of pointing out the obvious now. He's not like he's not in his emperor has no clothes mode. He's more now into the just like, okay, I'm not going to argue with you, dude. But when you're sitting here telling me that you got her pregnant, I'm not going to give it credence either. I'm just going to give you that look. Like,
I'm not going to entertain your delusions, dear brother.
Exactly. You know, so that, and then that's that right there. You don't know if that's a gambit that's going to pay off and piss him off more or less or whatever, but it seemed to have elicited the more measured response. Or maybe Ivar's just above caring right now because he's more concerned with his, what he believes to be his son, which he could be wrong on both counts on that, because it's he's already wrong on one of them. It's not his, but it could be turn out to be a girl. So,
oh, that'd be awesome. But it's interesting that he does have a measured approach from Fitzurk regarding the lack of response towards his child's divinity. Maybe because he's become accustomed to Fitzurk's response to that, but he has less of a measured response in regards to Fitzurk's talk of this other religion.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where he has this threatening way of talking to Fitzurk about Fitzurk's sanity now, like comparing him to Margaret and saying, remember what happened to her.
Yeah. 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 And we keep coming back to this point, though, between the two of them. We end off confrontations or conversations, one or the other, between the two brothers by a very, very thinly veiled threat coming from Ivar about what could happen to Fitzurk if he doesn't get with the program, so to speak. And then the next week, it seems to just kind of like reset back to square one, and then it has to build up to it again. So I don't know how much teeth any of that has, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Are you ready for Wessex?
Mm-hmm.
All right, we are going to leave Kattegat and head into Wessex now. And we are given one, it's not even a clue, we just have one brief scene of Lagertha, and she gazes down at Heckman's body. And we know this is still during the battle because you can hear the sounds of battle in the background. So we still have no answers or any indication of what is up with Lagertha.
I guess this is just to let the viewer know, like, if you were confused about everything, because all the hubbub in the battle and there wasn't a clear path for what Lagertha was doing, it's letting you know as the viewer that A, she's alive, and B, she wasn't taken hostage by anybody or anything like that. She's off on her own doing, you know, the gods know what. She's having some her time.
I still believe she's gone rogue. But I do feel like it's probably going to be like this sort of despondent zombie walk. if Torby's correct about her lack of reason or coming to the end of her reason.
Yeah.
But we have a quick scene with Bjorn coming back into the kingdom of Wessex and reporting to Ubba and Torby that he hasn't found Lagertha at the battlefield. He's convinced that if she's not dead, that she has vanished or fled.
Right.
Right. Alfred delivers on Egbert's promise next, which is what we expected of Alfred.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I had no doubt that he was going to do it.
Bjorn, who's like lazily sitting in a chair observing all this, just brings up, you know, the last time this happened, and he's cut off by Alfred. Alfred's saying, yes, I know about that, but that's not going to be the case this time. I'm going to not only give you this land, but I'm also going to help you defend it.
I thought it was nice that they set up the scene in such a way that we had a callback to Egbert's treachery about this, because this has been promised before, and then they actually got it, and then they were all killed.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, now that it gets brought up, and we're seeing that it's definitely going to go in another direction. Because otherwise, you know, as the viewer, you're going to start thinking back and going, wait a minute, why wouldn't, you know, this happen again, or why didn't it at least get brought up? So I always appreciate that kind of stuff when they go, hold on a sec, remember when? And then just kind of connect the dots.
And not only does Alfred follow up on Egbert's promise by giving them the land, but he also formally recognizes Ubba and his family as allies and friends. And this is done publicly. And this is one of the big problems with his rule. And he follows up with this with one more thing to address. And he has the people who have been conspiring against him arrested as traitors at this point.
So I'm not sure, but I felt like towards the end of this scene, you have all of the traitors being arrested with the exception of Æthelred.
Mm-hmm.
And you have Ubbe standing there who is in the know about what's going on. And he's holding the land deed that just got signed. And his eyes, he's looking off to the left, and I believe he's looking at Æthelred and just kind of wondering, like, okay, what's going on? Why didn't they grab him too?
It's possible that I know you said that when we rewound it, and I felt like Æthelred was actually to Ubba's right.
Okay.
It's like Ubba's off on his own thing now. Like, what happens with Alfred really only relies on him following through with his it does have an impact, because if Alfred was taken out by somebody who wasn't also rounded up with the other conspirators,
yeah,
the deed that is in Ube's hand could be null and void.
Exactly. So I'm wondering, it kind of leads me to believe, I know we trot this one out fairly frequently. Actually, we haven't done it that many times in this half season, but I feel like we're like venturing into deleted scene territory or American only kind of thing, where there's just a little tidbit that's taken out and we don't get until you buy the Blu-rays later on.
So next we have a really good scene between Bjorn and Gunnhild. He points out that she was the one who killed Heckman, which I didn't realize that was her when I watched it last episode, I didn't realize the person who put the sword in his chest was her. I don't know why. I just didn't. Mm-hmm. Did you?
Yes, I did. But I didn't think too much of it because of the fact that what she says here, like he was already pretty much dead. Like he had already had a few arrows through him. So she just kind of finished the job. It wasn't like, I think I would have thought more of it if they came to each other one-on-one combat and then she got the best of them. It would have been like, oh, you know, you killed somebody big here.
They both talk about their loss. They both talk about their losses as a result of this battle. She's lost her husband and he has lost his mom. And she's very matter of fact about the loss of her husband.
Yeah. She's just like, oh, he was a good husband. He was a good man. I'm sorry to lose him. But life goes on, right?
Bjorn offers to cut her ropes if she can answer a question about Lagertha's disappearance, which she really can't answer, but she does give an answer in general. And he does cut her ropes and he tells her that she can do anything she wants. And so she hits him in the face as a way to exercise her newfound freedom. Which is awesome.
It's a fun bit of playfulness. I like that. And she just kind of reclines on the bed, kicks her feet up, and then says, you can go. Just with a dismissive hand wave, like, bye-bye now.
It's a recipe for love right there.
Well, at least, Bjorn likes it. Mm-hmm. He likes that kind of thing. So you can see it on his face as he's leaving. He's just like, his eyebrows are up. He's like, really? Really? That's how you're going to be? Okay. I think he likes this better, but I also think that he had probably thought that, like, okay, I'm going to ask her a question. She may or may not know the answer, but I stay true to my word and I cut her bonds because she answered the question, not because she gave me what I wanted to hear.
Right.
And then I'm going to get something for that in return, like a favor. Like she's going to say, well, now that you've freed me, I'm yours. And she's like, no, she's not going that direction at all.
So you thought he was going to get something in return for that? I didn't think that at all.
I'm thinking that he thought it was a possibility. And then when he gets slapped and it goes exactly the opposite, I don't think he was expecting it outright. I'm thinking that he thought it was within the realm of possibility. Then when he gets slapped, he just, it's like cold water. Mm-hmm. And he realizes that this is going a completely different direction than that. So that's where the fun of it comes in. He would have been, I don't think he was expecting it, her to do that. And he didn't like, it wasn't something that he was going to press, but it was. Yeah.
So next we have Bjorn talking to Ubbe and Torvi again about the possibilities behind Lagertha's disappearance. Torvi thinks that maybe Lagertha has reached the end of reason and she could be wandering or whatever, like what I've already described earlier. I agree with Torvi.
I do too.
And there's a little bit of a tiff between Bjorn and Ubbe, which seems to be the pattern this season regarding how they act as Ragnar's son in a way. Like Bjorn points out the fact that Lagertha killed his mom. Why am I talking to you anyway?
Right.
That sort of attitude.
I like how Ubbe handles this. Like, we talked about this off podcast a couple of days ago, and I think it was after Wednesday night after we watched the show, but Ubbe is probably my favorite character at this point. And I feel that way because he's just so solid and stand up. And I feel like I really respect the way that he handles these confrontational little bits with his brother. And he doesn't, he makes his point and he says it. And then when, you know, Bjorn gets mad and says something else, he doesn't come back with a counterattack and try to hammer home his point or find the weak points in Bjorn's argument. He just lets him say what he's going to say and just leaves silence in the air and says, okay, well, that's how you feel. It's kind of like an unspoken, that's how you feel. I'm not going to change your mind. So I'm just going to respectfully stay quiet. And I think it allows Bjorn to just feel like maybe he knows that he's not completely correct in what he's saying, but he's been able to say it without being contested and he can move on. And so there's I don't even want to attribute it to like a deftness of manipulation on Ubbe's part. I think he's just, that wouldn't be it. It would be that he's just kind of like stoically bearing the fact that people are disagreeing with him and then letting the situation move on. But I
like that better than manipulation.
Yeah, yeah. I just think that like that's one way that it could be interpreted, but I choose not to interpret it that way. I'm just open to the idea that other people could see it like that.
We have Alfred and Judith discussing Æthelred's treachery. Alfred has already decided to forgive Æthelred without talking to him first. Judith finds this horrifying because she feels like they need to know why, and she specifically needs to know why so she can have the opportunity to forgive him.
So this whole thing with these specific characters, I start off on Judith's side and I end up going, what the fuck, at the end of it. Mm-hmm. So right here, I agree with her what she's saying.
Especially because we, you know, on Wednesday nights we go to my dad's house to watch it because we don't have the History Channel. We rely on Amazon to watch it, but it doesn't come out till, you know, the next day. And so when you watch on the History Channel, which as a lot of you probably do that are listening to us, you know that you get to watch the last week's episode prior to this week's episode, right? And when we got to the scene where Judith is telling Alfred of Æthelred's treachery, and she's got those fat tears running down her face, and I was like, oh man, I did not talk about how great Jenny Jack's acting is in that scene. I really wish I had talked about that on the podcast. And so I just want to give props to her. She's fantastic. Despite how you feel about her character's decision-making here, her acting, I mean, the writing already and the events are just fraught with all kinds of tension, but her acting just brought it up to that next notch that it needed to be at.
Turned it up to 11.
Yes. So I see in the next scene that the traitors are hung while Æthelred too observes looking like a Sith Lord. And I love the editing of the bodies because you have the one who's just shouting against Alfred as he's being hung, and then now he's dead, and you have the camera just on him, and then it kind of zooms out, and then you've got three bodies, and then it zooms out again, and you've had this line of, I'm not even sure how many bodies.
It was like 13.
13 that are just smeared onto the ground there. And it's really weird that it happens right before a commercial break. And I don't know why it's weird, but I just want to be like, ah.
We didn't actually start doing this tradition of watching it at your dad's house until last season or last year.
I think it was the season before. I think we've been doing it. This is our third season.
It is?
I think so.
Huh. But I know we didn't do it consistently the first for a while. It would be like an every now and then thing. But now we're doing it like pretty much every Wednesday. It's a date. And so like, you know, prior to this, we would see it for the first time whenever we could on Amazon right away and then watch it. And so you're immersed. But then when you watch it on the History Channel, and just like you just described, that the commercial breaks are jarring anyway. But after a scene like this, man, it smacks you upside the head. And you're just like, you're watching a GMC truck commercial literally less than a second later after you see these 13 bodies splayed out. And it's like, wow. I mean, everything has to be paid for. I get it. But the commerce it really bites into artistic value sometimes. I guess it's just something we're all learning to put up with, or we've always had to put up with.
Judith confronts Æthelred, and he admits his anger about having the crown pass to Alfred in his stead.
Yeah.
He tells her he refused to give the signal to have Alfred assassinated in his own defense, and he promises never to betray him ever again.
He also brings up how he saved his life on the battlefield, right?
Yeah, so... and this doesn't seem to, even at this moment, she is not mollified. Like, I mean, she just almost thrums with this sort of fear for what could happen to Alfred even after this conversation. You could see it's like every fiber of her being is just on alert.
It's definitely palpable in her like the body language acting that she's putting forth. And you know, I felt when this little mini scene was over, what I took away from it was the fact that I think that if you just look and listen to what Æthelred is saying to try to acquit himself, he actually makes good points. He did not give the signal. He saved him a couple of times on the battlefield, and it's never going to happen again. I did it. I'm wrong. I'm sorry. Right? The whole thing. But to Judith, this doesn't matter, because when he admits that he was part of the conspiracy, she kind of says something about that. She's just like, so you were with them. And that's when she really gets the way that you were describing. So I think what overrides any rationality that he can give, or rationale that he can give, or excuses that he can give, is the fact that she gets confirmation of his participation willingly. And that sets her off into another world. And there was no turning back from that point.
No, it's the fact that he has actually entertained betraying his brother.
Right.
That there's no room for that.
Yeah.
In her mind. And yeah. I agree with her. They're brothers.
Yeah.
You should not be thinking about killing your brother.
No, you should.
Unless your brother's fucking Ivar the Boneless.
But there's also, hold on now. He wasn't thinking about killing his brother, because he had said that Kynaherd had told him that he had assurances that if he did their bidding and took over as king with their support, that it would be a bloodless coup. So he had never planned to kill Alfred. He was just going to try to, like, go with them to take over everything, at least according to what he's saying now.
Right, according to what he's saying now. And you're right, I heard him say that to his mother. Of course, that's not how it looked.
No, it did not.
So whether that's the truth or not is up for debate.
I agree. I concede that point.
And then we have the Æthelbed situation later, which we'll talk more about later.
Yes. I'm not saying that she should, like, I'm saying that he, when I say that he acquitted himself well, I'm saying he put forth pretty rationalized reasons for why he did it and then asked for forgiveness. I don't think, most people don't ever get that in their life when somebody wrongs them or somebody that they love. They don't ever get reason, acknowledgement and then apology.
Right. Those, and change in behavior.
And a change in behavior.
Right.
Those three or four things are a fucking rarity in the real world. And Judith got them served to her on a silver platter by her son. And she still felt so compelled by the fact that he had thrown his lot in with these conspirators that the little flip, the little switch clicked in her head and he was dead at that point. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. And that's just like, and this is where Judith lost me, because I believe that leadership, and I believe that, now I'm a parent, so people are going to roast me.
You're not a parent.
It's apparent that I'm not a parent. I am not a parent, so people are probably going to roast me for saying this, but I think it should be like, I don't know. I think there's elements of leadership here. There's elements of motherhood here that are being thrown out the window in the way that she acted. But it was great TV to watch. So, but I started out this part of the episode totally on her side with what she was asking for and ended it going, what the fuck? So, and this is the turning point mm-hmm. right here.
Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that I would do what she did. Uh-huh. I think imprisoning would be better, but she doesn't have that power. So I guess she did what she could here. And sadly, it resorted to ending his life.
Yeah.
Because Alfred wasn't going to, and he's incapacitated at this point.
Right. Yeah. He can't intercede.
Or he's not incapacitated yet.
Well, he will be. So by the time she starts to do her stuff.
So before we even get to the event of her killing him, we have lots of other events here. We have a communion that's taking place prior to the actual land giving of East Anglia to Ubba and company. The communion is Ubba, Torvi, along with Alfred, and Bjorn's there observing, right?
I believe so, yeah.
And then we have where they're actually brought to East Anglia. They're shown the border, and from that particular border to the sea is their property. And Steve and I both lived in East Anglia, by the way.
We were joking about how, like, you know, where Ube's grabbing the soil and showing Bjorn, like, look how rich this is. You know, we can farm here. And it's like, yeah, we went to high school right there on that spot. Probably not.
Later on that night, in their newfound Viking colony, mass attendance is happening. And so everybody who's living in that area are heading that way, with the exception of Gunhild and Bjorn. They refuse to enter the building. Gunhild declares that they're worshiping a false god, and they decide to go and keep each other company elsewhere. And Bjorn talks of how this is all Ragnar's dream and how strange it is that it's finally been achieved. But Bjorn is grim about the whole thing, because there's been so much sacrifice, so much loss to achieve this. And if you really think about Bjorn's perspective, he's lost his father, he can't find his mother, his religion seems to be just unraveling, and here he has with him Gunhild, who seems to be just so Viking.
Yeah.
She's just like distilled everything of his childhood and what we were shown even in the earlier seasons of Vikings into one person. She tells him everything's going to be all right, and they kiss.
I felt like he was saying in a certain sense that, like, Here we've seen the, like you said, the fruition of Ragnar's dreams to be able to have farmable land for everybody. And it's not enough for him. He feels like I got to the end of the road and I'm not satisfied. Like there's going to have to be something more. So I'm just going to have to take a different road. And that kinship that he feels with her is probably pretty, like you described, pretty awesome, because they're just like going to be two peas in a pod going forward.
So next we have the king's men rushing back into the courtyard. Alfred has fallen ill, and Judith is there to receive this news. And she is immediately, you know, worried, probably thinking of treachery. But then again, we know that this has happened before. And in fact, I had to rack my brain to remember that. And it was, you know, the swamp plague.
Right.
So Apparently, this is a condition that Alfred has and is repeatedly afflicted by. Judith and Elswith are in Alfred's bedroom looking over his prone body, and we learn that Elswith thinks she is with child, and this becomes something that Judith focuses on, telling her that it's very important that she carries this child to birth because the whole kingdom depends on that.
Because I'm about to kill his brother, so we've got to make sure this baby lives.
And that's when Æthelred enters the room, and he says that he has to live, and that's the only thing that matters now. Yes, and that's interesting to me because that's echoing Judith's thoughts, and that's going to be her primary motivation in killing Æthelred.
Yes. You know, I feel like he might have been putting it on a little thick for her here, just to just to kind of come in and say, like, my poor brother, you know, the like.
It's like Magnus saying, I am Viking.
Right, right. Who are you trying to convince here?
Right. But it's interesting that he's speaking her motive out loud at Alfred's possible deathbed here.
Like
it's almost like got this Shakespearean quality to it.
It does. Yeah, because you feel like underneath it, the undertone is him like going, Mom only cares about you, bro, so get better. Like, for real.
Not really.
Not that Shakespeare would put it that way. He'd be a little bit more poetic, but.
So next morning we have Bjorn talking to Gunhild again, regretting not offering their gods as a sacrifice as a way to garner their protection towards this new settlement. He also regrets Torvi and Uba's conversion to Christianity. And this is where you've touched on this conversation where he's talking about how he needs to do something for himself. He wants to take Kattegat back from Ivar. And she mentions, well, you don't have an army. And he thinks that, well, he'll just join Harald and persuade Harald to join him in attacking Kattegat. But it turns out that Harald has already decided to do this. So Bjorn thinks, well, then it should be easy. And she's like, yeah, or he might just decide to kill you.
And I love how they don't say anything after that. Like, she leaves that hanging in the air, and then he just stares off into the distance. Like, he might not even be thinking about it anyway. But, you know, like, his thoughts just went somewhere else in that typical, like, you know, Bjorn fashion or whatever. But it doesn't faze him at any rate. He's just like, well, yeah, that's a possibility. I doubt it. But, you know, he can try, I guess. But we're going to go do it anyway.
We have another nice scene, which I think is probably one of your favorite scenes, with Bjorn saying his goodbyes to Uba and Torvi.
Yes.
It's funny, I wrote Uba and Ragnar.
Well, when Bjorn says...
It is Ragnar's dream he's saying goodbye to, right?
Yeah, there you go. So it's not... I mean, he's... Well...
He's saying he's going to achieve another version of Ragnar's dream.
Right, right. You know, we've talked about the idea before about how, like Ragnar almost got splintered into a little bit, got put into all of the sons. So each one of them got something, and, you know, Bjorn got something else than Ube did. And so, but when Ube says, my brother, still my hero, I thought that was just a really touching moment, and it kind of cements like what I was saying about Ube being my favorite character recently for me.
Yeah, it's a nice thing to say. And I kind of got the sense that Ube doesn't necessarily believe it, but he felt that it was important to say it.
Hmm.
Like, I think he felt in the past that Bjorn was a hero to him.
Ah. Okay. Well, yeah, maybe he's saying it to say, like, in spite of our current differences lately, I still want you to know that,
like, things haven't changed, brother.
Yeah.
You know, it's just another way of saying that. Like, we're always going to have that bond.
You're the wind beneath my wings.
Yeah. But anyway, next we have Judith addressing the lords about Alfred's current state of health. The lords are alarmed by what they perceive as weakness. Æthelred steps in to calm the men. Judith is alarmed by Æthelred's popularity. She wants to know what he whispered to them. He says he said what he has a mind to say, attempting to put her in her place. He tells her to go make some stinking borage to help heal his brother.
So did you notice how she comes up behind him and says, you know, what you know, kind of like lets him know, I have a mind to, or I want to know what you said to these people. So he flips around and, like, grabs her by the arm and pulls her and goes up the step that she was just
pushes
on.
Pushes her down the step.
So now the power inversion between them is not just, you know, like, metaphorical. It's literal.
Right. That's why I described him putting her in her place.
Ah.
So I did notice it.
Okay. I just did, like, because the whole... Because he was doing it verbally for sure, but then he did it like in a physical sense too. Because he's not too much taller than it really, I don't think. But he definitely got up on that other step, and he was like, yeah. So I guess maybe they're setting us up here to like not be quite as sympathetic to him. So I don't. like whenever, you know, because we know what's coming down the line.
Well, it makes me wonder if there's been a lifetime of this. He's talking about the stinking stuff that she makes. Like, you know, maybe the focus and attention that she's had on Alfred has maybe been an annoyance.
Well, you know, I don't have a brother. I just have a sister. And I also don't have any, like, half brothers or sisters or anything like that. So from my understanding, there's usually this, or there can be, I'll say that, there can be this family dynamic where if children have different parents, if the mother liked one of the fathers better than the other one, sometimes that kid gets better treatment. And it's maybe it's in subtle ways, and then sometimes maybe it's in not so subtle ways. And it's definitely going on here. So I think that because of who Athelstan was and what he meant to Judith, was she's always favored Alfred heavily. And I think she's probably tried her best to be a mother to both of them as much as she can, but I think Alfred's always taken the priority.
I don't know. I think her and Aethelwulf developed a pretty solid relationship in the end. It wasn't based on love, but, you know, I think she loves Aethelred. It's just so much conflict surrounded her relationship with Athelstan for her, and that she had to fight for survival even for a period of time. So maybe there's a little bit more wrapped up into it than just a simple "I loved your dad best" sort of thing.
Okay, all right, I can see that.
I would like to give her more credit than that.
Sure.
Okay. That's what
I'm not arguing with you.
Because I think that's lame.
It would be, but I'm glad you put up that defense, because it does seem like that. So,
and we have a scene of her foraging for mushrooms, and when we were watching that, my dad's, both of you, and we're like, "Oh no, she's just looking for stuff to heal Alfred." I'm like, "No, she's not."
Yeah, that's what I thought. I thought she was looking for some sort of something potent, the stinking borage to make him better. But no, I was wrong.
Next, we have the Aethel bed scene. I know it sucks that his mom kills him, but this makes it almost okay that she did here, because his wife is actually celebrating the idea of his brother's death in a greedy way, you know. And
right.
First of all, come on, girl. You have to know he would be king if his brother died. Why are you even asking this question? Are you a fool?
Yeah. Yeah. She is, I think. Yeah. But she should still know that. Like, as foolish as you might be and as young as you might be, she should still have an understanding of that.
I mean, surely that's not there just for exposition reasons or just to inform the audience, because we all know that if Alfred dies, that Aethelred would be king. So we're just supposed to believe that she's an idiot.
I can buy that, though. I mean, I feel like she should know it, but I can freely buy that she's an idiot. I mean, she was like Cuthbert's daughter, or Cuthred, right?
Cuthred.
Yeah. She was Cuthred's daughter. I mean, you think she would know just because of that, but at the same time, I don't know. I don't really know where to land on this. She is being stupid, though. She's being stupid.
Yeah, because especially if Cuthred was involved with the other conspirators, and they're all, you know, supporting Aethelred as king, of course she would know.
So you know, and then we extend our whatever little bit of, like, whoa, you know, Aethelred's not acting like he should, by the fact that he doesn't give an immediate rebuttal and just shut that down and go, "Hey, you're talking about my fucking brother who's sick right now."
No, I'm just going to lay here thoughtfully and let you entertain the idea and bask in the idea of my brother's death. Go ahead and do that. Have fun.
So I encapsulated this scene into a poem, or not a poem, but like a little limerick line. And it says, "Fled wants Fred dead, and Red can't get it out of his head." All right, so we can move on from that.
Maybe Judith has spies also, and this is why the next scene happens.
I can buy that. I would have loved to have seen it.
Yeah.
To like,
maybe that's in another version.
That could be. I'm open to that possibility, and it would actually,
because it involved us seeing Aethelred's ass mid coitus while these spies were looking in, and so that's why it was cut out of the American version.
Because
so
we can't see butts. We just can't handle it.
Yeah, we can't handle butts.
Right. I can say this. I can say that if we did have these connective tissue scenes that showed that she had spies and they reported back to her this kind of stuff, I would feel, I would move a little bit on my assessment of her, because at this next scene that we're coming up on, it's just brutal to me. It's just brutal.
It is brutal. It's brutal because it happens. How it happens, but her response to it is brutal too. That you could see the pain that she feels, the fact that she's doing this to her own son. She loves him.
She's definitely conflicted. Yeah. She doesn't become a 100% evil person or character because of this. It's just that, anyway, let's get into it.
Yeah, so they're having dinner and they're discussing the lack of progress in Alfred's condition. Judith again addresses the conspirators, but she's more addressing like the new crop of them that are developing in response to Alfred's health, and she feels that they're not Christian, that they're lacking charity towards his illness. And Æthelred agrees with that, but then he says that you must understand their fear, and this is where I think maybe if he just hadn't been this way at all in the first place, and yes, it's a commendable way to empathize with others and try to understand why people are upset, but the fact that you don't have a hard conviction or hard stance against it in front of your mother, that's what sealed the deal. That's why you're dead, dude.
It's like his mom was Dick Cheney, you know what I mean? And then like she's got somebody under her going, you're either with us or you're with the terrorists, you know what I mean? And it's like, you're not trying to understand the terrorists and sympathize with them, but you're going, well, like, look at historical context here about what's going on, blah, blah, blah. And then it's like, no, you have to take the hard path or whatever. But
because he says, you know, for the sake of England, you have to try to understand because these people care about England, the conspirators.
Yeah.
And so he starts to show signs of the poison taking hold. And she stands up and starts talking about, well, if they really cared about England, then they would care about our king, because certainly they have to see that he is the answer, that he is the solution for England to move forward. Mm-hmm. And it's like she's having to coax herself through what is happening. Like she has to justify the event that she has set in motion.
So you mentioned Shakespeare earlier, and this does, from the little bit that I know about Shakespeare, this does all seem very Shakespearean, in air quotes. Mm-hmm. It's a lot more visceral and fun to watch, and it makes for great TV. Mm-hmm. But I feel like as leadership, you know, going back to him saying, well, you have to understand what these people are saying, and they love England too. Good leadership, to me, in my mind, would have dictated that, like, okay, if we really care about England going forward, we don't need to round these people up and kill them. We need to sit these people down and neutralize them as a threat, point one. But point two, find out what their grievances are, see what we can do about them, and entice them to come over to our side and become our allies first and then our supporters, and solidify the power base.
And our problem solvers in regards to what they're concerned about.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I don't consider myself to be a leader, but something like this seems to be fairly self-evident.
Yeah.
So the paths taken towards this are like not the right ones, mm-hmm. in my mind. But like I said, they make for great, great TV viewing.
Right. And that's what he was basically putting forth, I think. And that is the right way to be. But the thing is he's saying this in front of a person, and he's alerting them to a past trauma. She's lost her reason in the way maybe that Torvi has speculated about Lagertha. Maybe that's a parallel thing. She has come to the end of reason.
Okay. I can totally buy that, actually. Yeah.
Well, you know, with like repeat, you know, Lagertha's had her repeat loss of love and, you know, so the straw breaking the camel's back. And so here's Judith's equivalent straw. And we know she's a killer anyway. So.
Oh, yeah, because, I mean, with one thing we talked about, too, is you think back to what she did to Quentrith, mm-hmm. when Quentrith was with child. Mm-hmm. And so it's in Judith to do this kind of dirt. But the one final thing before we move on from this is, you know, earlier we talked about when Alfred was sick and Æthelred went to his bedside, he was speaking the intentions of his mother, like how he thought she saw things. It seems like Judith is actually talking about the conspiring nobles and the people who are being, you know, unrestive because he's ill, because Alfred is ill, but she's ascribing things to them, but it's actually describing her. Not real Christians, no charity in their souls. They simply want to get rid of him. That's how she feels about him.
Good
at
call.
That point, because I mean, what could be less Christian than killing your own son? You know, there's no charity in her soul for forgiveness to, you know, and then they
talk
simply
talk about contradictions.
Right. They simply want to
get rid
of her.
Or is she on her Buddha journey right now?
And she's saying these things as she's eating and she's shaking.
Yeah.
You know, and so if she's on a Buddha journey, she is, man, she needs to get some training wheels or something, because she's not getting very far on it. Bitzerk's
rolling
doing
downhill fast.
Bitzerk is doing better than her. You know, if that gives you a barometer of this.
But, you know, as he's dying, she says, "I don't believe you ever accepted your brother as king or that you ever would." He says, "What kind of mother are you?" And he looks you know, he's dying. There's no recovering from this. There's no antidote that's going to be given. And he says this right before the thing that shocks me repeatedly every time I see it, the head slam into the table. It makes me gasp. It's horrible.
I'm so glad they did that, though, because it doesn't let the audience off easy.
It doesn't let Judith off the hook either. I mean, right. She doesn't just get to watch him die of poisoning. There's more of a violence than what is expected of that poison that's happening right in front of her.
Yeah. It's overkill almost, but it's like, you're right. It needs to be shown to us. We don't need to be let off the hook. And she definitely doesn't need to be let off the hook. And like you, just echoing your sentiment from earlier, kudos to Jenny for doing it like this, because I mean, she just nailed this. I mean, this was that confliction. And then when she's crying and she has him, you know,
cradled.
Like, yeah, it makes me sad, but
she weeps over him and she even holds his hand.
And I think probably, you know, she
makes
was
me want to cry.
She was probably going to get to somewhere in the neighborhood of that reaction, regardless, even if he had started cursing her. But I think it made it worse because she's sitting here talking about how he would never, this was necessary because you were never going to accept your brother as a king. And he's like, screw all that. You're my mom and you did this to me.
Yeah.
And that just probably just twisted that knife in her heart, which she deserves.
She deserves
every last bit of
it. I agree with that, though. I'm conflicted about it all. I do wish he had a harsher stance against treachery toward his brother.
And so, you know, all the kudos that we give to her, also to the you know, Hurst and the writers of this episode, because I mean, it's just so well done that we can have something this far into going towards the end of a fairly long series, you know, that elicits this much emotion, especially from characters that two or three seasons ago, you know, if they even existed then, we didn't even really give a flip about too much. So that's awesome.
Yeah, this has been a great couple of episodes.
Yeah,
really enjoying it.
I will be the first to admit that after the previous episode, episode 5, with the big battles and stuff like that, I felt like there was we were going to have a slightly tending towards the mediocre in this episode, because we've seen that happen before. They kind of settle down and get everything reset towards another climax later on down the road. But that did not happen this time. We kept up like the intensity, and I really liked it.
All right, so we're going to head into feedback, and I want to start with a couple of tweets because we have people tweeting at us lately. So we've got the King of the North. Have you guys checked out Norsemen on Netflix? It's dope. Should really check it out. We've seen the first episode, and it was funny.
On the recommendation of your dad.
Yes, and we need to go back and finish it.
I think after we finish this season of Vikings, that'll probably be something that we watch just for our own fun and enrichment. So yes, we have seen one episode, and we are going to check out the rest.
We have BMO Dolo saying, in regards to Fitzerk, with a gif here on our Twitter, "This poor kid has been getting crapped on way too long from Daddy to Ivar. Same face, LOL. He's snapping now with Buddha on his side, and what can go wrong being the peaceful Viking?"
With the little Buddha influence, maybe he's going to
become the peaceful Viking.
Yeah, like that's part of his trajectory, possibly.
Yeah.
I mean, that's
he's going to be the Morgan of the Viking. community.
Walking Dead reference there.
Yeah, it's about when I quit watching The Walking Dead.
feels like about 10 years ago.
And we also have another tweet from BMO Dolo in reference to Bjorn, and he says, "That's pretty much the whole episode this week. Bjorn's thinking face still wasn't a bad one." So he's got a gif of Bjorn with a grim looking expression on his face, which, yeah, I mean, I don't think he likes what he's seeing, and he's just kind of in a grimful way, just taking it all in. And, you know, I actually like Bjorn more these last couple episodes because of it.
I do too. I agree with that completely. But I also will say that sometimes his thinking face makes me think of Patrick Starfish. So
why?
Because like there's been episodes where SpongeBob's like, you know, like talking to Patrick, and then he looks over for an answer, and Patrick's like, "What?" like he wasn't paying attention the whole time, and it seems like you could almost get that reaction out of Bjorn. Like, he's not thinking of anything, and then when somebody finds, like, "Bjorn, what do you think?" and he's like, "Huh, what?"
All All right, so we're going to head into our feedback section from Gmail, and we've got up first Sophie Fatale, who we haven't heard from in a long time.
Well, well, well.
What's up, Sophie? She says, hi, guys. So I just moved apartments, and it's all been very crazy. I binged episode 11 through 15 in your podcast during the holidays, and now I'm finally caught up. I finished the latest episode before the deadline, only to realize I have fuck all to say about it. What a boring episode. I just finished it 5 minutes ago, and I can't even remember anything that happened. Oh, Judith killed Æthelred. The scene with her making potions felt like a parody, though, or like some sort of cartoon villain. Well, since I'm caught up, I may have more to say next week after what's hopefully a more eventful episode. I kind of hope Alfred gets pissed off with his mother whenever he wakes up. I hate micromanagement. Let me just finish by saying I'm glad Vikings is back, and I really enjoy the podcast as always. Until we raid again, Sophie Fatale. So we've got somebody who didn't like the episode.
I see what you're saying about, we didn't really comment too much on the scene where Judith is actually gathering the mushrooms, but it did, I won't say, I didn't take it as cartoonish, but I thought she looked witchy in a way, because you're so used to seeing Judith all dressed up with her, I don't know if you want to call it queenly garb, but she kind of dressed the same way when she was queen. And then, you know, then.
I mean, wouldn't it be accurate though?
Yeah, it would. Yeah, it is. I'm not knocking it. I'm just saying, like, we didn't really talk about it. So here's a chance to, because I felt like she looked like, witchy, not in the Wicked Witch of the West kind of way, but
like in the Stevie Nicks way.
Yeah, there you go, Stevie Nicks way. And she was getting, well, I'm sorry you didn't like the episode. I just thought, I mean, even if a lot more stuff was not as good as it was in this episode, I still think the Judith and Æthelred scenes would have, you know, pushed it up to a full, you know, 10-point rating.
Yeah, I enjoyed this episode, and part of it was due to the shock value of it, because I wasn't expecting it, at least not so soon. I really didn't expect Alfred to be incapacitated so all these other events could take place. I thought it was going to fall to Alfred to make these decisions about what was the fate of Æthelred. And so I was taken by surprise with that, and then, you know, the acting just put it over the edge for me as far as awesomeness. So, again, Jenny Jacks did an awesome job.
Well, hopefully you like the next episode better, Sophie. That's all I'm saying. And thank you for writing in. It's nice to hear from you.
Yes, nice to hear from you.
All right. Up next, we have a first-timer, Julianne. And she says, hi, guys. I'm a longtime listener and first-time emailer. I absolutely love your podcast about Vikings. I wanted to share my breakdowns of this week's episode, The Buddha. This week's episode was a tribute to mothers everywhere and could have been named Mommy Dearest. First up, Bjorn. I've got some mommy issues. I lost my mother in the battle. I must find her. Gunnhild. Your mother? Slap, a la Cher in Moonstruck. Snap out of it!
Snap out of it!
Did this remind anyone else of the season one fight/lovemaking scenes shared by Lagertha and Ragnar?
No, but now it does. Because I think you're accurate into pointing that out.
I agree. Sigh, those were the days. Has Bjorn finally met his match? Will the loss of his mother finally let him become open to another woman's love? Is it too coincidental that this woman looks so much like Bjorn's first baby mama? You know, I hadn't thought of that until you brought it up. Thorin.
Yeah. It's like she's Thorin reconstituted.
Like Thorin, the way that he probably would have wanted her to be, like this warrior who could just go out there. Because, I mean, she lost her shit and just had to go off on her own because her face got cut up. And interestingly enough, his face got cut up by this woman. Will she play the foil for the guilt he's been burying all these years? Interesting. Well, I know he absolved himself of some of this guilt by his goodbye to Torvi in this episode. So that, you know, I don't know how he's ever felt about the death of his first child, you know, that he never seemed to even really acknowledge that happened. So,
yeah, I mean, there doesn't seem to be any indication of guilt.
Yeah, that's maybe that's just not it's an act of the gods, right? The gods decided that. Why should I feel guilty? So Julianne goes on to say, Torvi, the badass mom. Yes, Bjorn, you are a horrible dad, but I am the badass shield maiden that made up for it. Do you even know how many kids you have or their names? Sometimes me and Ube want to see a movie and would love to drop them off at your hut.
Ellipses.
Judith, the scariest mom of them all. Yikes. You know you're in trouble when she strokes her goblet like Ecgbert used to. Has she been waiting years to take vengeance on the son that bound her to the family she was loath to stay with? Did she make a deal with the devil, making her absolutely ageless? Sign me up for the Viking Age oil of Olay she's undoubtedly been making these past couple decades.
Yes. She must have an Etsy account. Maybe we can all get in on that.
You know, you're bringing up dredging up old conversations here, because I remember we haven't done it in a while, but I remember there used to be a lot of talk about how the certain women didn't age on this show. And we haven't discussed that in a while, even though the show's progressed longer and they still haven't aged.
You and I haven't discussed it, but we've had people mention it in their feedback from time to time.
Yeah, but it reoccurred more, or it was more reoccurring, I guess I should say, in the past. Anyway, Julianne goes on to say, Alfred's wife, the pending mom, she must protect her unborn child, says Judith. But whose child will she bear? Alfred's? Bjorn's? Advice, stay away from the potions your mother-in-law makes. Also, you may want to start trying out one-eared hairdos now. that's if this gets found out. You know, I was thinking about the Alfred Bjorn child thing, and I feel like this was Alfred's child. And I feel that way because we've seen a significant amount of time go by as far as just judging by, Alfred was able to grow facial hair, you know, and just certain events have transpired. And then when we finally get the news that she's with child, it's a bit further down the road. So I think she would have been showing already if this was Bjorn's. But that's just my speculation. I have no idea.
You know, what would interest me would be Judith's reaction if it ever came out that Bjorn was the father of Elspeth's baby. Because she would have reason to empathize, right? But then at the same time, this is Alfred, and it would be a threat to Alfred in some way as far as, like, not cementing his seat on the throne, because he doesn't have that heir just yet, not a true heir. So how would she respond, especially since she has come to the end of reason?
Judith would drown that kid in a heartbeat. If everything is as you just described it, I think she would have the perfect motive to do so, unless she felt like Elspeth was either incapable or undesiring of getting pregnant again to have an actual heir. Because you could kill your own son. You're gonna be able to kill a son that came out of your wife's your daughter-in-law that doesn't even have anything to do with him. Easy.
Yeah.
Okay, so Julianne goes on to say, Æthelred's wife, the wannabe mom, after so many husbandly duties performed, it's only a matter of time. Was Æthelred's final act finally impregnating her? Will her child be the true heir to Wessex should the paternity of Alfred's wife's child be questioned?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I would think so.
Great point.
I mean, there's been reading some of these, you know, histories in England and the Viking world. There's been some way more tenuous claims to the throne than that. Magnus, I've got a crazy mom. Don't you say that about Mary Moon. Ragnar was going through his oriental medicine phase at the time of his conception. Was he too whacked out to know if he really had sex with Quentrith? Or did he lie about doing so because admitting to having sex with her would have totally demolished any credibility he had left?
Would it have?
I don't know what to make of that. Because I feel like at that point in time with Ragnar's character arc that we as the audience and people who were living with him inside the show as characters probably expected anything. So I always felt like, I still feel like Magnus is not actually a Viking, and they keep keeping that fresh in our faces by him like claiming the opposite. You know, I think something is going to come to pass. I don't think he's going to survive past this half season. That's just my guess.
I mean, the fact that he does the run and hug with Bjorn proves he's not a Viking.
Right, exactly. Because that's not something like Bjorn's probably like, what the hell? What are you doing? You know, my kids don't even do this.
He might as well have just like jumped up on him and wrapped his legs around Bjorn's waist.
It'd walk with me, you know, and you would grab your dad's leg when you're a kid and he would walk around.
Bjorn's just like bouncing him on his hip.
Yeah.
Baby Magnus.
So, you know, I guess I just don't, I don't think that that would have destroyed Ragnar's credibility at the time. And I just keep going back to this whole idea that Lagertha doesn't believe it. Ube doesn't believe it. And we as the audience never really felt that way. So I don't see why he would have lied about that. Like, what would one more woman that he had sex with made a difference in the whole scheme of things? Why would Quentrith have to have been a secret? So anyway, Julianne says, thank you for letting me share my thoughts with you, and thanks for so much for all you do. You guys are awesome, Julianne.
Thank you, Julianne, for writing in. We hope to hear from you again and again.
Yes, thank you. Awesome to hear from a new one. Up next, we have Brian, the tan Viking. He said, well, it's kind of coming together. Bjorn finally gets with Harold. I don't think it's going to work out. But if it gets him to Kattegat, it's worth the mean mugs from Old Fine Hair, and he showed he still had it by slicing up that freaking tree man Viking. Ube is definitely the Ragnar of them for sure. Look at the treasure, Bjorn. Look at the treasure, Bjorn. Bjorn probably thinking, that's dirt, dude. Woohoo. He's got bigger and brunetter things to do. Are they Bjorn or Bjornheld? Doesn't matter. He has his woman now. I think that's the last time he'll ever see Torvi. It just felt like a real goodbye. I don't know. I'm just glad to get the ball rolling on the taking back of Kattegat. And if he gets some English help, he'll be good. Or Uncle Daddy Rollo. I don't believe he's not going to be back. But we'll see. I don't believe he's not going to be back. We'll see. But I can't see Ube not following his big hero bro. Mine too, lol. I just can't see him staying while the remaining brothers fight. If anything, he has to slap Mr. I'm Viking now, Magnus. Ugh. Hate him. Bald Viking with a moderate tan out. Bye. It would be so awesome if Fitzurk said bye while leaving, wouldn't it? But again, bye. Thank you, Brian.
Bye, Brian. Bye. Yes, it would be awesome to see Fitzurk saying bye as he's, you know, left Freydis dead on the floor as a gift to Ivar on his way out of Kattegat.
In the same way that, like, they were like, they just knew that that sacrifice wasn't Lagertha, he could just be like, well, you knew that wasn't really your kid, right?
Bye! Thank you, Brian.
Thanks.
Up next, we have Raven, and Raven says, hey, one and all. Well, another episode, another week of shifting pieces and questions. Here are some thoughts. Doomed plans. Why do I think both Floki and Bjorn are being led astray? Floki might lead into a trap by Helgi to the exiles, which might be the doom by Helgi's father and of the Iceland colony as a whole. Bjorn is laying himself open for a trap by Finehair. He did not look pleased to see Bjorn this episode, and maybe he wants to take down Bjorn for many reasons. Bjorn swaying Halfdan to Lagertha's side. I forgot about that. Good point. Bjorn taking Harald's boat. Bjorn kicking Harald's ass in battle and taking a potential spouse. What I don't get is why Bjorn is being dumb unless it is a ploy. Well, I mean, he's got a pattern, right? Like, isn't he just kind of dumb about a lot of stuff?
Yeah, this is predictable behavior at this point.
But I think he's not as dumb as he used to be. I think he's getting some wisdom here. Raven goes on to say, brothers, do you remember when Ube and Fitzurk were kids and they walked on the ice and fell? Well, at the time, I thought it was just child's curiosity, but what if it was a setup for more? Both brothers are now curious about the world and other faiths, Ube's Christianity and Fitzurk's Buddhism, and they might fall in exploration of those faiths. I like that. Update. My Fallen Queens theory from a couple episodes ago is coming more into fruition with this episode. The beginning of Lagertha's fall was when she killed Auslaug in the back with an arrow. Judith's is now the poisoning of her firstborn son, Æthelred, for Alfred's sake. It would depend on who will be the one who will bring her down. Alfred? Æthelfled? Æthelred's wife? Who knows? Anyway, hoped you had a great new year. You too. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
To Raven and to everyone.
I like this idea of the fallen queens, or the falling queens, I guess you could say. I think that
Judith's fall maybe with Quedthrith, Mary Moon.
Yeah, and this is going to be the catalyst. This killing right here is going matricide, I guess you would call it, or is that no?
So that'd be that's the killing you, of your mother. Yeah, so okay, that would be. This is, I don't know what son.
Yeah,
is
I don't know, but killing your own son is this is a bad thing on any number of scorecards.
Yeah, I mean, the gods are going to be after, at least like, you know, the Greek/Roman gods will be out for you, mm-hmm. The fates.
Right. And the Christian god is not going to be happy with this one. Yeah. The gods of the Aesir, I think they would probably need a better reason, maybe. They'd be okay with the act if you had a good enough reason. Maybe they think this is all right. I don't know. I'll have to check on that one. But I think Lagertha still has a chance for some sort of redemption because I think she's suffered enough for her killing of Auslaug, in my estimation. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of thing has already come to pass. And this is more about soul searching and finding her true path and, you know, stopping the whole bouncing off from like betraying man to betraying man is what I think. And I also like your ideas about how both brothers are curious about the world and other faiths with Ube's Christianity and Fitzurk's Buddhism. And so I don't know if they're necessarily going to fall in exploration of these faiths. So I'm not sure if I agree with you on that point. It's definitely a possibility, but I think this could be a path forward for Fitzurk, at least, to where if he could incorporate some elements of Buddhism, it could help him see where he actually needs to be. And then, you know, in a little bit of assimilation and incorporation of other elements is not a bad thing.
Thank you, Raven.
Thanks, Raven. Up next is Sarah, Dr. D's Donuts. Call her what you want, but she's here with some feedback. She says, Happy New Year, No Shippers. Can we just have a moment and appreciate Steve St. Ledger as a director for this episode and the past two episodes? I feel he really put his 3 years of experience as second unit director to good use because the staging and blocking were so glory days Vikings and made them a pleasure to watch. That said, this was more of a solid B.
Hmm.
All right, so we got another vote of not so hot of an episode. Donuts goes on to say, Judith never really had a chance with Ekbert lurking around and torturing her and manipulating her all under the guise of Alfred's protection. Then you examine the literary tropes signaling Æthelred's, quote, evil ambitions, black hood wearing, husky whispering, lusty wife banging, mom grabbing. I'm not saying it's fine, but I'm not surprised. The acting in their final scene with her shrieking and him struggling to make sense of it was mad good.
Mm-hmm.
I read recently on Kelly Campbell's Instagram, she plays Kettle's wife, that Hurst often references classical artworks in the script to communicate how he wants something to look, and they clearly ended mimicking a Pieta, Mary with Jesus draped across her lap. Gorgeous, dark, ironic. Interesting. Cool. Other great stuff. Bjorn finally acts like the Bjorn we know and gives Torvi her due props. Can we just stick with this version of Bjorn?
Yes.
Please, please. That was one of the better scenes of the episode. It was really nice to see him doing that. She goes on to say, I love that he and Gunnhild are like Uber Vikings. Olives and who? Ivar and Fitzurk were absolutely hilarious this episode. Ivar with his what? And Fitz with his little Buddhism 101 quotes. They remind me of my former high school students. Sometimes it's easy to forget Ferdia Walsh Pilo is only 18, but then they haul him inside like a sack of potatoes. He's doing a great job, and I love that with Ube behind him, Alfred feels like a big man. Adorable.
Yeah, I'm really happy with the casting of Alfred and the writing behind Alfred. It's been one of the best parts of this season so far is seeing Alfred blossom on screen.
Now, if you'll excuse me, I need to go adopt a puppy or something, so I'll stop mother henning all of these nearly grown men. Dr. D's. P.S. Iceland still sucks.
It does.
Agreed.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you, Sarah.
Up next, we have Nancy, and Nancy says, I don't have a lot to say about this episode, but I'm not sure I can take another death of hunky eye candy. Although Æthelred was devious, he was just starting to get interesting and naked. I'm a big Jonathan Rhys-Meyers fan, so I'm still mourning Heckman, too. Oh, well, back to rewatching The Tudors. And she signs off with Nancy, and then she says, P.S. The news of Six being the final season makes sense. I'm bummed to see the show end, but it's probably time. Yeah, it feels right.
It does, yeah. Mm-hmm. I would have been bummed out if it ended a couple of seasons ago because I would have felt like there's just a lot of story we weren't told and a lot of potential that was unexplored. But I don't relish the idea of like a season 8, 9, and 10 just trying to like figure out what is going to happen with a whole new cast and so on and so forth. So it feels like just so.
Yeah, I'm happy to have Ragnarsson's be the reason behind the title Vikings, that it wasn't just about Ragnar, mm-hmm. and we're actually going to see all of their stories tie up. So that's ultimately what's going to satisfy me. And then the journey that we've had watching it and with our listeners, and it makes me sad to think about that this podcast will also end as a result.
Yeah, yeah, I know. But, you know, there's I don't know. I mean, yeah, I can't really add anything to that. You said it all.
But, you know, we still got approximately 2 years, guys. So.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're going to be doing this in like the very beginning of 2021. So we'll still be kicking it around for a little while. I mean, we're just at the beginning of 2019.
Yeah.
So everybody, I hope all your New Year's resolutions are staying strong. I hope everybody's staying safe for the new year. And that concludes our coverage of this episode. This has been a No Ship Network podcast. I'm your host, Steve.
And I am your host, Em.
Axe time.
Sword time.
Shields are splintered.